group bug codes of behavior.
What's the matter, man? Got bugs in your machine?
The bug must ruminate all...
From the Beat Poets to the Summer of Love, from the gay rights movement to the dot-com boom, San Francisco's got a reputation for being at the front of the curve in all kinds of ways. Now, the Californian city's pioneering another movement, the eating of insects, or entomophagy, to use its technical term. New Zealand might have its Huhu Grubs and the Wild Foods Festival. San Francisco's got restaurants, food trucks and websites devoted to cooking and eating beasties like crickets, mealworms and larvae. And this isn't all about novelty or some gross-out factor either. No, as we discussed a few weeks ago, farming and eating insects as an alternative protein source for the world's growing population is being taken pretty seriously by the likes of the UN and the European Union, who are investing money into industrial bug farming. Peter Jameson of the San Francisco Weekly has just written about the city's move towards becoming a hotbed of insect cuisine.
We have a street food festival that's very popular here in San Francisco that took place in August, had 60 vendors, was attended by tens of thousands of people, a lot of them very much into food and foodie types. The food cart that was specializing specifically in insects and preparations involving insects, it's a cart called Don Bujito, spelled Don Bujito. It's run by a woman named Monica Martinez. She was selling wax moth larva tacos at this truck, and they actually sold out. She was also selling a dessert dish. It was ice cream with caramelized worms sprinkled over the top, and she sold out of all of her food, so it was very popular. I think there are a few factors that contribute to this. You know, the Bay Area is known for pioneering food fads of all kinds, and not just fads, but longer-term trends. You know, many of the country's most prominent organic farmers and farms started in this area. You know, other food movements in recent years, such as wild and foraged foods and biodynamic wines, they all tend to find a very eager audience among San Francisco consumers. So this seems to fit within that broader pattern.
So it's more than just novelty factor, or do you think that's still a key driver that people wanted? It was the first time that they'd had access to insect meals, insect-based meals, because I imagine for a lot of people, they're still unable to go to a supermarket or there's no viable market for buying insects if you want to start cooking at home.
That's true. There's not. And with one exception, this is another interesting aspect of San Francisco that perhaps makes it more conducive to entomophagy, is that there is a very large Mexican immigrant population, immigrants from other parts of Central and South America. And in those countries, entomophagy is a very accepted cultural practice. You know, in the Mexican state of Oaxaca, they actually shun shrimp. They won't eat shrimp, but dried grasshoppers are one of their most popular snack foods. And there have been places in San Francisco, particularly in the Mexican neighborhoods, where you can purchase dried grasshoppers or other ethnic insect foods, but they've tended to run into problems with health regulators because, you know, American food regulations are really not geared to insects as food. You know, the federal and state regulations where they speak to insects at all say things like, well, you can't have insects in your kitchen. Well, if you're cooking insects, then that obviously doesn't quite work. But as far as the novelty aspect of this, that's certainly a part of it, and I'm sure that's a huge attraction. And I think the jury's still out on whether this will really take hold and whether this will be a food people regularly turn to after the first few times they've, you know, had the fun of trying a worm taco.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that we accept shrimp, lobster, and crabs from the sea, and yet the notion of an insect, which, from what I've read, I mean, it is pretty similar when we term in terms of classification and evolution to those animals that we desire from the sea, and yet we shun them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the similarities are quite strong. I mean, many insects will actually trigger shellfish allergies in people who have them. And this is a favorite talking point of entomophagists is that, you know, scorpions or grasshoppers are you know, essentially the same. You know, they're a land-based arthropod, and crabs and lobsters are a water-based arthropod. You know, they've tried to rebrand them with various cute names like land shrimp or terra prawns, and none of those names really seem to catch on. But, you know, I can tell you, I sampled a number of these insect preparations, and many bugs actually have a less pronounced flavor, or, you know, a flavor that's less offensive to people who, you know, don't like a particularly strong flavor than, say, shrimp or crab or other types of seafood.
And interesting there that the fact you have this protein-based exoskeleton, especially for a lot of the adult insect forms, means that there's a crunchy shell. I mean, I haven't eaten insects, but I'm just imagining here. We hear a lot about larvae and worms. Mealworms seem to be a very popular insect that is consumed, which my understanding, again, is a larval stage of a beetle. That would be a soft, creamy type, almost like a ricey type texture versus this crunchy insect, which you very much, I mean, if you eat a shrimp with a shell on, you know you're eating a shell.
That's right. And you know, one of the cardinal rules of insect cookery, as it's been expressed to me by veteran entomophagists, is that, you know, you want the bug to crunch and not gush when you bite into it. You know, most people find the idea of a you know, fried or roasted crunchy insect more palatable than something mushy. But you know, in my opinion, actually, the bugs with the you know, they have that chitinous carapace, that exoskeleton, that actually has that's probably the strongest flavored part of the insect. It has kind of an iodine aftertaste, which, to be honest, I didn't find completely agreeable. I personally preferred some of the worm preparations, the wax moth larva. You know, when they're fried in butter, they taste and have a texture very similar to mushrooms. I mean, you could eat it, and if you didn't know that you were eating a worm, you wouldn't really be able to detect that from tasting it.
Yeah, but I mean, anything fried in butter is good, isn't it?
That's true, yeah.
I mean, you could fry in old sponges. Well, in terms of you mentioned there the food, the FDA, the food, you know, the regulatory body there that administer food regulations in America. What do they? There are no regulations whatsoever about consuming insects. I mean, that work has not been done in terms of, do they carry, you know, contaminants, pesticides? You think about the industry that is dedicated to killing these things.
Yeah, no. There's really a bare bones regulatory framework. In the U.S., most of these regulations about food safety come from the federal government, so they come from Washington D.C. And again, they're not geared at all towards bugs as a food source. I mean, one thing they do say, for instance, is that in any pound of produce, you can have X fraction of it that's made up of insect parts. You know, that's one irony of Americans' attitudes towards eating bugs, is that, you know, all of us are actually eating bugs already in contaminated vegetables that we have, because our regulatory agencies allow a certain level of contamination from bugs that get ground into different types of food. But you know, there's really nothing. And I spoke to a local health inspector here in San Francisco who, you know, really can't make heads or tails of this issue, because, you know, he recognizes it's a novel thing and a growing food trend. And, you know, there are many potential ecological benefits to entomophagy. But, you know, he doesn't know how he's supposed to regulate food vendors or food trucks or restaurants that are selling these items.
And the food truck phenomenon, that is very much a West Coast phenomenon, isn't it? That sounds as if that over the last couple of years has really grown. And I might get you to explain exactly how the food truck system works, because essentially it's a mobile restaurant.
Sure. It's a huge thing. I mean, it's sort of the defining culinary movement in San Francisco and in Northern California right now. Essentially what it is, you know, you've got a food vendor that will get a large van. They work out of the van, very small kitchen, you know, similar to kind of the old school hot dog vendor. But it's a very easy way for young chefs or chefs that don't have, you know, money or investors to, you know, rent out what would likely be a very expensive commercial space in San Francisco to get up and running and get some recognition for their work. The food trucks do have to submit to regulations in the same way as the restaurants do. So, you know, this food truck, Don Bujito, it will be interesting to see how our regulators handle this first insect-only food truck that's going to be around.
Yeah. And what is happening? Why do so many people find the idea of eating insects so repulsive? It's disgusting. Is it the fact that we, and I've got to be careful there in the way I use the word we, but a lot of people have been brought up thinking that insects are dangerous? You know, there's bee stings and wasp stings, and we get bitten by mosquitoes. They can kill us. Scorpions can kill you. Is that association so close and so strong that for a lot of people the idea of embracing these animals and consuming them it's anathema?
Right. Well, and you know, I think discussing the we in that formulation is important, because the idea of eating insects is, you know, frankly disgusting to most people in countries settled by Europeans and, you know, people mainly with residents of European descent. In other parts of the world, in Central and South America and Southeast Asia, they do eat insects, and they eat, you know, a wide variety of insects comparable to the range of, say, seafood that we would eat in the Western world. You know, for every entomophagist or every person with some expertise in cultural anthropology you speak to, there's a different theory about where our aversion to entomophagy in Western countries comes from. You know, it was not always there. You know, one famous bug cooking author here, David Gordon, likes to point out that John the Baptist subsisted on a diet of locusts and wild honey. So somewhere, you know, between then and now, this revulsion we have towards insects came about. And, you know, the theories you listed are all popular ideas about what could have happened. That, you know, I know in the U.S. at least, in the past 60 or 70 years, we've had a number of very, you know, spooky ads featuring kind of monstrous images of cockroaches and snails from pesticide companies. There is a theory that, you know, insects became vilified at some point even further back, because they were our primary competitors for different food crops that we had. But there's no single theory, I think, that's really predominant. There are just a number of speculations that people have.
Peter Jameson and Peter writes for San Francisco Weekly. And it's interesting why some people find the idea of eating insects so disgusting and do everything to keep them separate, and yet others crunch happily away on grasshoppers, spiders and other bugs. Daniel Kelly has just written Yuck, The Nature and Moral Significance of Disgust. And Daniel, hopefully you know, why do we find the idea of eating insects so darn disgusting?
I think with insects, there's probably a double disgust whammy against them. So on the one hand, disgust, it's very sensitive to the sorts of things we might eat. I mean, humans are omnivores, so we have a whole lot of possibilities on what we might consume. And disgust is this, you know, sort of the psychological mechanism that helps us whittle down the possibilities. So it's already sensitive to stuff that we might put in our mouth. On the other hand, disgust is also very attuned to things which might infect us or poison us or carry some sort of germ which might make us sick. And insects are pretty good candidates to the sorts of things which, they're not going to maul you like a lion, but they might infect you with something, or they might sting you and poison you in that way. So disgust is really tuned into insects, and it's tuned into food.
So is it too crude to say that disgust is just an emotional response?
No, I think that's about right. It's a fairly complicated emotional response, but it shows up on anthropologists and evolutionary theorists who study the evolution of human cognition. It shows up on almost all the lists of emotions that you find across cultures. So disgust is supposed to be something that all humans share. The ability to be disgusted by something, like you mentioned before, what exactly it is that triggers disgust, that can vary from culture to culture, but it seems like we all have the capacity to be disgusted.
And how much of that response then is innate? And you alluded to before the fact that we're with food, we're programmed to avoid stuff that may infect us. And I guess the same would apply to rotten foods or foods that are you know, heavily infected with bacteria. bacteria, which is, I guess, what rotten foods are. How much of it is innate versus how much of it is programmed in through association, through people saying, this is disgusting, this is disgusting, this is disgusting?
Yeah, it's useful to separate out, like you just did, the capacity to be disgusted, so that response, versus the sort of things which can trigger the response. So there's a good case to be made that the response itself is largely, the heart of it anyway, is innately specified. So no one has to teach you how to be disgusted. It's not there right when you're born. Looks like the full thing doesn't come online and sort of integrate until about 3.5, 4 years old. And there's different data on this, so that's not real settled. But it's certainly a couple years into the game that children develop the capacity to be disgusted in its full aspect. But what is disgusting? There's some things which look like they're innately and so universally disgusting. The sort of things which are associated with infection or moldy food. So like rotting meat, there's a good case that that's something which is likely to be disgusting to everyone. Things like pussy sores on someone's face, anything that indicates that someone might be infected with a disease that you could catch. There's a good case that those might be universal triggers of disgust as well. But then once you move on from there, disgust is very sensitive to social influences. So which specific foods are disgusting in one culture versus another is something you probably learn when you grow up from your peers, maybe from your own personal experiences with different kinds of foods.
So, I mean, that is cultural. And I guess when we look then at the example there of eating insects, in some cultures, they're revered, and you know, people will shun lobsters and prawns and crabs.
That's definitely right. And with food is one of the easiest places to see this. So when I grew up, the very idea of eating raw fish was just revolting. But now, you know, I go out for sushi 2 or 3 times a week. I love it. Other things like vegetarianism is certainly on the rise here in the States. And a lot of vegetarians claim they don't just think it's morally wrong to eat beef, for instance, but they're just repulsed by the idea, while other people, you know, love a good rare ribeye.
And it's funny, you use the word repulse there, and just saying disgust or repulse means your muscles in your face, your cheekbones sort of go up, you pull back your lips in a sort of, your eyes slightly close. I'm doing it now as I'm sort of talking to you. I mean, there really is quite, a strong signal there, a physical signal from an individual when they are disgusted or even saying the word disgusting.
That's definitely right, and it looks some of the most interesting recent findings on this. The face is one way you can physically emote. There's a whole suite of elements to body language, but the face is clearly the most recognizable one. And some of the most interesting recent findings is it's extremely hard to prevent yourself from making that face when you're actually disgusted by something. So even when you would rather not let other people know that maybe you find their the food they just served you to be completely gross, you tend to make that face. They call them micro gapes or micro expressions. You tend to make that face even when you don't want to.
Oh, that's tricky socially then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And can we become sensitive or desensitized to things that disgust us? And I guess if they are bound up in culture, and your analogy there of sushi is that I can quickly desensitize myself to the smell of open sewers. And I guess, personally speaking, they're having had children, just dealing with nappies, I think you guys call them diapers, you know, the idea of another child, you know, I mean, that whole area is just a no-go zone, but yet there's something, you become desensitized to your own children's feces, which is, I guess, what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, there's. I think this is a really interesting question because there's the issue of just being able to override your own disgust reactions to sometimes and to do the best you can to just sort of put your head down and push on through and change that diaper. But then there's also the question of it looks like some of what disgusts you is very fine-grained and automatically calibrated. So it looks like. They've done studies. I haven't done studies on this, but psychologists have done studies on this. Women tend to have a dampened disgust response to the nasty diapers of their own child. in a way that their disgust response is not dampened to the nasty diapers of other children. So there's something very specific about this. Other recent work has shown that the elderly people, sort of the older you get, you tend to not be as disgusted by elicitors, which are typical like death-related indicators of disgust or elicitors of disgust. So that falls off a little bit as you get older. But disgust elicitors from other domains, social disgust or food-related disgust, it doesn't show the same fall off as you get older. So there's some really interesting subtleties going on here about how much you can change what disgusts you and how much it disgusts you.
What's happening to us physiologically when we are disgusted? I know with, you know, fight or flight or fear, a lot of those other results, you have the skin temperature, you get heat, you get a quickening of the pulse, a restriction of arteries. There's lots of stuff goes on physiologically. Has anyone mapped what happens when someone is disgusted?
That project is still ongoing, but there are some good, interesting findings that you can latch onto. So a lot of the so-called basic emotions, the one you just mentioned, the flight or fight response, it tends to cause a slight spike in your heart rate. Disgust is interestingly different than a lot of other emotions because it causes a slight dip in your heart rate when you're disgusted. So there's a physiological marker you can look at. Other things related to disgust, you can sort of connect with that gate face that you typically make. So that's external. It's a behavioral component of being disgusted. But it also, a lot of the same facial motions that are involved in the yuck face are the same sort of facial motions you make when you're about to retch or when you're actually about to throw up. Part of what happens when you're disgusted is it activates your digestive system in interesting ways. So the flash of nausea, which you typically experience from the inside when you're disgusted, is actually produced by happenings in the gastrointestinal system.
Right. And again, that would suggest that it's very strongly a protection mechanism. If it was going to basically, you know, this idea of being so repulsed and disgusted that you would empty the contents of your stomach is saying, this is a built-in protection mechanism.
Yes, I think so. My view on this is disgust is an emotion which only humans have the full emotion of disgust, but the components of what we now recognize as disgust can be found in other animals because it has actually a dual origin. So on the one hand, disgust is this protective mechanism designed to protect us from eating things which might disrupt our digestive system, basically, which might cause us gastrointestinal distress. But the other component of disgust is a different kind of protection mechanism, and it's designed to protect us from parasites, basically, contaminating microbes, anything which might get us sick and infect us. So we have this one emotion, disgust, which is the result of these two different protective mechanisms basically becoming intertwined.
Daniel Kelly and his book Yuck, The Nature and Moral Significance of Disgust is published by MIT Press.